Today is July 14th, 2021. This is episode number 551 of the Apple Context Machine. It's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, head cheese puff. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, you can shoot me a note over at macobserver.com/contextmachine. That'll take you to our Facebook group. And on this particular episode, we're actually continuing the conversation started in episode number 550. And my guests are returning, both John Keat and Jeff Gamet. Let's do, I think I did Jeff first last time. John, we'll do you first today. Hey, John.
How you doing?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thanks for being here. Jeff?
Hey, it's my pleasure.
I'm already done with you, John. Jeff?
Brian, it's so great to see you. John, it's okay seeing you too.
We really need to do this in a new form where all words are allowed.
Yeah, right. So today, later, by the way, I'm going to tell you how you can save up to $120 on a molecule air purifier. That'll be later in the show, though. The topic, we have one sort of overarching topic again this week, and that is the most consequential and impactful features in Mac OS or OS X or Mac OS, which was what it was before OS X. And I have a challenge for you both, and this is really aimed more at John than Jeff. Rather than just like talking about like every feature that's sort of like vaguely cool, let's try to keep it to the ones that are, that have been actual, like that have been meaningful. Because I feel like we really kind of diluted it last time. I'm looking at you, John, with your shared notes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it depends on what you think is meaningful. I mean, the features are what they are. Like, you know what? Since you know so much, start and tell us your meaningful feature.
Oh!
You see, John, you don't need to have extra words.
Yeah,
you made your message really clear. Yeah, totally. Well done, sir.
Totally, you absolutely and positively did. How about, I'm going to actually kick it back. Old school. Look really old school. Pre OS X, and I'm going to say preemptive multitasking. Apple was super late to the game on that. But when they added it, it was a huge game changer for the Mac. And it's something we take completely for granted today, but I think that's probably the case for most great technologies, especially at the OS level. You know, it becomes so indispensable that we take it for granted, probably means it was super important when it came along.
It was super important when it came along because it actually made what we were doing. Like if you were in a production environment, it made what you were doing much more bearable because you weren't essentially limited to a single task.
Right. And when, I bet John actually has the answer to this, when did preemptive multitasking actually get added?
In the Apple world, it's kind of a weird roller coaster ride. It really started with Lisa OS because that was based on Xenix, which few people actually remember. And they did quite an overhaul of that OS at one point, but it had multitasking. Then
it was Mac OS X. It wasn't Mac OS.
If you're going for proper preemptive multitasking
in the Mac,
Mac OS for Server 1.0 was the first time it came in, and that still had the Mac OS 9 UI, but the next step underpinning. So that was probably the first version of that that came out, not including any betas that preceded it. And before that, it was next step. Really, this is just all a prolongation of next step, which came out in 88.
So there's a couple things we three and maybe our listeners took for granted too, and that was that because the first episode on this, last week's episode, was about iOS, it essentially has been, you know, since the iPhone was released, which is post Steve Jobs coming back for several years. But I think for the Mac, that it's fair to go back not just to the beginnings of OS X, but to go back even to the, you know, to the original Mac, if that's what we choose to do. Do you guys agree?
I agree.
I totally agree.
Which is why I mentioned Lisa OS.
Yes.
From 83.
Indeed. Kudos, sir. What was the wicked fast one?
Wicked fast one.
Yeah, the Apple Apple 2SG, GS 2 2GS.
Oh, the 2GS? Oh, wow, you're going
the Apple 2GS was an awesome computer, even though it wasn't a Mac.
Is that the one I'm thinking of?
It was a 8-bit and 16-bit processor that supported Apple II software and had a graphic interface that that looked like what the Mac had, but it had color and it had sound, it had expansion slots.
Did it have preemptive multitasking? That was my question.
No.
Okay. Oh.
So no. At the Apple II OSs did not have any kind of preemptive multitasking. No. Got it. Okay. Thank you.
Not without weird hackery. There was in 84 when the Mac first came out, there was a multi-finder app that came out, and it's not the later one that came out officially from Apple. I think it was in OS 7. And it did a really weird time slice, but I'll add a second feature to the multitasking, which I think may in some ways be more important, because I don't think the average person really gave a darn as to the difference between the preemptive versus cooperative multitasking that the Mac had with iOS 7, which is memory protection. Because when one app bombed on the Mac back then, all apps bombed on the Mac.
It was much awful. Greater
likelihood. So you kind of had the effect for most people that you had multiple apps working. You still had the window mess all over your screen, right? You could go from one app to the other, and it felt like you were multitasking, even if that one wasn't doing a lot of processing in the background. For most people, it seemed that way. But the problem was it would bomb a lot, and the system would come down. So, yeah, in addition to the that basic technology of preemptive multitasking, it was also the protected memory spaces.
Yeah, that makes sense. So I know you didn't expect me to have one, John.
And I did. And it was a fair man. I knew you'd get it.
It was a reasonable bet on your part to make, but I actually did have a couple prepared. Regardless, who wants to go next?
I'll give you one.
Okay.
Apple Talk and Local Talk. Apple made local networking easily accessible and affordable to the masses.
Doable by mortals.
Yeah. And, by today's standards, not efficient at all. But the fact that you could take, a handful of Macs and Apple LaserWriter and whatever, and just string all these things together with local talk connectors and phone cords and have a network on the fly. I mean, that was just amazing and game changing. I agree.
That's a good one, man. That's a good one. All right, John.
So, this goes back to Next really, but everything we have today is, I could just say Next Step, really, is really a descendant of it. But one of the big things it brought, what made the App Store possible, what made these transitions from one processor to another processor possible, the entire nature of the ecosystem was the, I guess it's kind of two pieces that work together. One was it's object-oriented programming, And the second was the nature of the kernel. That kernel was highly portable. Everyone always makes a big deal like these processor transitions are a big deal. They're not. For the vast majority of apps, it's literally a checkbox. And it's been that way since like 1989 or whatever. But those two pieces, the object-oriented stack that Next came up with that we're still using today, you know, just much better classes and toolkits that we have with it, and the kernel structure there really allow that kernel was designed in Carnegie Mellon to be decoupled from the hardware really easily. And that's what allows these fast transitions from one processor type to another so easily. And that's just, it's been revolutionary. You wouldn't have the iPhone, right? Like that was a port. So all these things are made possible by those two pieces.
Tell us when that became part of OS X.
It was part of OS X from day one. So Mac OS for Server 1.0. The public beta, which was called Kodiak. I never knew until I looked it up. It was there from day one. That's all the Next stuff. But those two pieces, the mock kernel and the object-oriented stack, allow for these unbelievable migrations of the technology to just all these different kinds of hardware platforms. And it is app meaningful stores and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it is a super big deal.
It is a super big deal. I'm going to go with my... Are you done with that one, John?
Yep.
Super good one. I'm not trying to sweep it away. I'm going to go with and now I am completely forgetting the name of the original font in Mac OS. Is that TrueType? TrueType fonts were a very big deal for computing as a whole. Actually, did Amiga do for fonts, since they were well ahead of Apple on a bunch of well ahead of the Mac on a bunch of things. What did either of you know what Amiga did for fonts?
They were bitmaps, as far as I remember. They had cool variations of their bitmaps, where you could have multicolor bitmaps, which eventually the Mac also had. But I believe they were all bitmap originally. I don't know if they. I assume. Remember what was that Adobe product that came out? Before Apple did, it was like this init that you loaded basically gave you like these rasterable fonts through system-wide. I forget the name of it, but I think that was before Apple actually adopted the full TrueType stack in Mac OS, you know, 7 or wherever it was.
That was such a fascinating time frame for a subset of us that... Yeah. We're into the design and font technology because, the whole thing with TrueType, Apple was using it and that was kind of a Microsoft team up also. And it was to give their platforms a leg up over some of the stuff Adobe was doing. And that ultimately led to craziness at conferences with unplanned announcements from CEOs, like on the spur of the moment in response to what other companies were doing. And for Adobe, they had to scramble because here's Steve Jobs saying, and here's TrueType fonts, and we're giving away this technology. People can use it for free. And then I think it's Joan Warnock jumps up and says, and we're doing the same for PostScript. And then Adobe's like, holy crap, we're what? And it changed so much. I mean, it really just kicked off all of that that really good competition between typeface technologies.
I have a
I think the PostScript thing came from Adobe first, and they were keeping it all locked up, and the TrueType was a response.
That's mostly exactly led right
from Microsoft. And so really what started off was were the PostScript, I think, type one fonts, which have just finally been deprecated out of the system, I think.
And that's In part because Adobe is also setting PostScript typefaces aside.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, they've already dropped support, I think, in Photoshop. Yeah. It's okay, so to spin off of what you just said, I'm totally throwing another one out that I think was huge because, you know, ultimately we got the trifecta for desktop design, which was PageMaker on the Mac, PostScript from Adobe, and the LaserWriter.
Yeah.
And that changed everything. And there's a group of people out there that they just suddenly had their trigger word come in. And I'm sorry, I said PageMaker without giving a trigger warning.
I love PageMaker, man. PageMaker was amazing.
That's because you didn't actually have to print anything from it. Like, you know, like it goes on to a press printing.
No, I did not do press printing. I did essentially individual, like I did my own marketing materials.
Yeah, and you could do really cool stuff with it. But this is why for a long time Quark Express was the king, because it proved to be much more efficient in an actual production environment for so many companies.
It could have stayed that way too if the Quark people weren't like insane, but that's another story.
Oh boy.
So I have a good follow-on to that difficulty that was really solved. So it was originally Display PostScript, and then what became Display PDF.
You just took the pick right out of my mouth.
And sorry about that. And we have a unified, resolution independent display engine for the display on the Mac, and it not only makes getting output out the way you want it much easier, it also makes these resolution independent displays so you could have much higher display resolution on your, whether it's the iPhone or the Mac or the super high def screens. It just becomes super easy, and that was all really started with the Display PostScript and then the Display PDF tech that came in the early version. The early version of Next and the earliest version of Mac OS 10, or really, Mac OS for Server 1.0.
I have an...
That didn't have it. Mac OS Server for 1.0 didn't have it because it still had the old Mac OS 9. So that really was the public beta for Mac OS 10.
I have a type story.
Yeah. Sure. Okay.
If the dogs will cooperate here. So I had a CD of all of Adobe's fonts. This was an Adobe CD. Mm-hmm. So it was a CD from which you could purchase fonts.
Right.
And this was in another era. Well, I don't know. Maybe the print world, maybe the graphics world still pays good money for fonts, but there was like some specific fonts that I wanted to use, and I think these were, I think this was when I had a web development company, and I had gone through this CD and I was excited about it, and I was looking at the different packages, and there was this one package that had all the fonts that I wanted. And that was the thing. It's like, they were individually tens of dollars or more. And this is at a time, this is in the 90s when tens of dollars was certainly more than it is today. But at that time when I was pretty broke, it was all the money. And the bundles would package up multiple fonts, obviously at a discount. And so there was this one package that had the fonts that I wanted, but I couldn't find any pricing for it. And so I ended up calling Adobe, and they had phone sales supporting buying fonts at this time. And I get a guy, and I tell him, so I'm looking, I can't find any pricing for this one particular package. He says, I'm not familiar with that package. And he put me on hold for a few minutes, and he came back, and he said, yes, sir, I can get you that package, which essentially includes all of our fonts, and that'll be $875,000. I think. time may have messed with my memory on what the actual price was, And it may have been then's equivalent of today's $875,000, but I would swear that that's what it was.
That's crazy. But the fonts are still super expensive. They have like annual sales on, I forget, it might be fonts.com. And you still see, I forget, was it Linotype and Adobe fonts are still lunatic overpriced. Yeah.
But yeah, the whole world of font licensing has really evolved over the past few years. And now, at least when you're in like the production world, the way you're licensing these, it's no longer, I'm just going to buy this font and install it on my computer. It's gone to the subscription model. So let's say you're a web designer today, and you and you're using specific fonts on someone's website. Well, you as the web designer, you'll have your annual license that you're paying. But then your client, when they have the site up and running on their servers, they need to have their own license as well. Now with Google fonts, depending on what you're using, it's either, oh, well, this is just part of the open set of freely available fonts we have. But still, you know, each entity needs to have their own license, whether it's a free license or paid license for that. And, it's becoming a mess and a big headache for a lot of people, because now it's suddenly really hard for people to know if they have fonts in whatever it is that they're doing that had been properly licensed.
Yeah, it's one thing that is weird. I wish that they would update the PDF panel in the print panels to have a checkbox to say, you know, include fonts, you know, either just the necessary characters or the entire fonts in those, because sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. And that's always a fun time getting that straight. But yeah, I've stopped, you know, as much as I always loved having cool fonts, and I still have one of the few apps that I think it's Metamorphosis that lets you edit those fonts. And it's just a fun, I don't know, weirdly kind of like relaxing Zen garden stone thing for me to do that. But I just stopped adding any fonts, except I think I have a folder of like 8 fonts, and I don't install them in the system location anymore. I install them under my home library in the fonts there, so they can't mess with any other account stuff, because the fonts still work poorly. There's still weird conflicts. There's still just weird isms that you would think after this many years, this would be a problem solved. But I find every time I do, you know, install all the fonts that I really like, there's always weirdness in the system. I don't know. Maybe you've got it more tamed, Jeff. I wonder if you still have a ginormous, you know, font library.
I have an insane font library, which, you know, it's just a side effect of having done so much over the years where I've needed to have so many different fonts. But my
careers
need to
1 through 42, I think. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. But my need to be able to have specific fonts available all the time, it's not there anymore. So I'm not even using a professional or a commercial font manager app anymore. Mm-hmm. And I'm just using Fontbook to turn fonts on and off when I need them.
It's a different world. I think even I don't know. I can't speak to the world of designers like I was about to. I too have lost that obsessive desire to have all the fonts. I really don't care anymore.
Yeah. Basically, for me, I'm at the point where I need to have a readable serif, readable sans serif, a nice oblique font, a nice headline font, and maybe a decorative font.
Yeah, fair enough.
And that's it.
Fair enough. All right. Who knew that fonts would take us down so many rabbit holes? But that kind of speaks to the importance of, you know, going back to TrueType, that becoming so important for so much of the Mac user base back in the day, really does speak to the power of that particular technology. And that all stemmed out of Steve's obsession with calligraphy and you know the classes that he quote unquote audited at Reed.
Yeah. And it also gave us the painful abomination of font DA mover.
That triggered. Yeah, that triggered me.
Yeah, sorry. Trigger warning.
Okay, who's next?
You.
Me?
Oh no, you just did that one.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What are you talking
about?
Is
it me?
Yeah. Let's go with you,
Jeff.
Let's go with John.
Okay. Well, to take it a little bit out of kind of the fog of Genesis that we've been going down, just kind of an everyday, well, I guess this is still part of the fog of Genesis. It's, again, a combo of one thing that really means many other things, but user accounts, you know, yeah. Having to log in OS X. Not that I think most people don't use multiple user accounts, or maybe families do. I'm really not sure. But what it also brought is security for the first time to kind of the Mac. The whole ethos of you have a username and a password. So one, you could have a separate user account, which is the obvious thing there. But I think it really started the ethos of security in the system, which was a big deal because Mac OS 9 and earlier were not secure.
You just boot, and there you are. You have access to everything.
So I agree with everything you just said there, John. And I will add that there are families in particular who should have and use user accounts who don't, and they don't know that it's there, and they don't even think about it. And I think that Apple's done, this is one of the infinite areas where Apple has done a very piss poor job of educating its own user base as to the tools that they have available that could actually solve their problems. Yeah. And to that extent, I'm surprised that user accounts haven't been nixed.
Well, and you wonder, will they ever bring them to iPads or even iPhones? Like, I guess user account on your iPhone would actually be pretty useful for, I think, a lot of people for their kids. It certainly would be useful I would suspect a fair number of households have a shared iPad, right? And
Apple still sees them as single user devices, which I don't think is going to change.
Yeah. Well, took 3 years for copy paste, so there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, Apple has missed a really good opportunity, going back to what you said, Brian, about educating their users. When you do the initial setup of a Mac, it gets you to the point where you have to set up a username and password. But it doesn't tell you, hey, we can set up usernames and passwords for other people that are going to use your computer too. Do you want to go ahead and do that while we're setting everything up?
Yeah, and that way they can't see your stuff and you can't see their stuff.
Right. And instead it's just, you need to have a username and password. So you put that in and that's it. There's nothing that indicates really that you can have more accounts.
Or even do you want to set up another user while we're here?
Yeah.
It could have been done even more straightforward if they'd kept going with some technology, meaning you kind of have a list of users for the household in the home app, right? From iOS side of, these are the users that can, have access to the HomePod and whatnot. And Steve Jobs back at Next had something which was basically a universal account. And what would happen is it didn't matter which Next Cube he logged into. When he logged into it, it would pull down kind of like a Dropbox version of the entire account to that local machine. And any changes you make would get synced up back to the server. And so he could go from machine to machine and do that. And that functionality was in Mac OS up to about 10.6 or 10.7. And then they basically started to take it out because it was, tricky. But if you had that today, just think about what could happen. You could have one general account that is available on your Apple TV, on your phone, on your iPad, on your Mac, and it just comes to the device. And in that sense, when you're setting up a new Mac, when you're setting up a new Mac, it would just say, hey, there's six people that I know are in this household. I'll just set up all six accounts. And then you could walk up to it with Face ID, which hopefully eventually Apple will put Face ID on the device it was destined to be on, which is a Mac. And it would just take you right to your account. It could be so smooth and easy, but Apple's been in the business of taking away features instead of adding them. So there you go.
I remember an interview that Steve gave. I have looked and looked. I think I've asked you if you knew what this interview was, John. I'm sure that I've talked about it with Jeff, but I've looked and 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 I've never been able to find it again. And it was, I believe it was from shortly before Apple bought Next and he came back to Apple, but he was talking about like the power. No, I'm wrong. He was back at Apple, but OS X had not been announced yet. And he was talking about the power of exactly what you just described, like being able to log into his account no matter where he was.
This is not a theoretical thing. This existed, and it even existed on Mac OS for a while, but very difficult for him. You needed Mac OS server to set it up.
He was talking about the fact that he was still using Next because it wasn't on the Mac. And he was talking about the, you know, the power of being able to log into his work account from, you know, his home or from his bathroom or whatever it is. And at that time, you know, probably required a T1 going to his house, and right. Not everyone could have a T1. But I was enamored with that from the get-go and was always bummed that Apple didn't end up making that a thing after Steve Jobs had talked about how important it was to him.
So it's a great feature to add to our episode about all the great orphan products and features that Apple has, you know, killed off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For sure. Like Command D for don't.
Yeah. I'll add one to that list. Color sync.
Hold on. We should actually do a separate episode for this. So, all right. Yes, we should. Jeff, your turn.
Okay. Color sync. Really?
Oh, I thought you were talking about things that have been deprecated.
Well, it has, but it's also...
Oh, this is this is the other side of the coin.
Yeah, the other side of the coin. Color Sync was a game changer because you find... You had this amazing built-in system for creating color profiles. And those profiles could be shared. So a device maker, say a printer company, they could give you the color sync profile for a specific printer, and then your scanner company could give you the color sync profile for their specific scanner, and then you have the profile for your display, and then color sync under the hood would look at all of these and say, okay, so this is how this document actually looks. Here's how the colors in this photo actually look. And so you'd have this consistent view across all devices. And when I say this is how it would actually look, not exactly, but
it was, and print thing too, was
you
right?
had a baseline. Yeah. You knew exactly what to expect from anything that you printed.
Yeah, and it was a huge benefit for the Mac. And it was, as we'll end up discussing in another episode sometime, really weird when it was killed. Like, why are you killing this? Doesn't make any sense.
It was really weird because that was one of the linchpin features in Mac OS for people in serious production environments. They needed that to have color consistency across their projects.
And they added a kind of version of that on one of the latest TV OS updates where you can get your TV to be a little more color accurate. I don't think it uses color sync, but I think it's the same, you know, philosophy in trying to get colors to be more accurate.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's doing a screen calibration.
Yeah.
All right. I have another one, but before I do, let me tell you about a molecule. All right. Molecule. My long-term listeners have heard me talk about this product many times. I've got two of them that I bought. I love having molecules in my home. especially when fire season kicks in around in these parts in California, when the air gets horrible outside, my air on the inside is great. And I love that. It's actually why I originally got them, and it's why I love still having them. So Molecule is reimagining the future of clean air, starting with the air purifier. It's not just an innovation on existing technology, but a scientific breakthrough in air purification. Molecule's core technology, PECO, or photoelectrochemical oxidation, actually destroys harmful pollutants in the air like viruses, bacteria, mold, and chemicals, instead of just collecting them on filters. Molecule air purifiers are designed to help protect homes, businesses, and medical spaces, so you know they're destroying pollutants and providing clean air. Molecule air purifiers destroy the widest range of pollutants compared to traditional air purifiers. That includes, again, viruses, bacteria, mold, allergens, and chemicals in the air. Molecule air is designed for large rooms up to 600 square feet. Molecule air mini is designed for small rooms up to 250 square feet. Molecule air mini plus helps protect small rooms with a particle sensor and auto protect mode, which adjusts fan speed based on the sensor. And then there's Molecule Air Pro, which is designed for extra large rooms up to 1,000 square feet. And then the Molecule Air Pro RX, which has received 510K Class 2 medical device clearance for medical purposes to destroy bacteria and viruses in the air. And again, here's the important thing to me. I love having them in my home. I love having them in my home. Fire season is... technically, it's probably on right now, but we haven't had a lot of fires here in the Bay Area in California. But when we do, the air can get really, really bad. Like if there are fires up north, sometimes even if there are fires up south, down south, a lot of times the smoke and particulates end up, you know, just sinking here into the valley. And I love having these things in my house. And here's the deal, because you are a listener. Because you're a listener of the Apple Context Machine, for a limited time, you can save up to $120 on Molecule air purifiers by visiting molecule.com. That's M-O-L-E-K-U-L-E.com. And use promo code ACM. It's for Apple Context Machine. You can enjoy free shipping and a 30-day at-home trial on your order. Once again, that's code ACM at molecule.com. And I want to thank them very, very much for sponsoring this episode. Okay, for my next one, I have a gift and a curse technology. Mm-hmm. Extensions in the original macOS.
Wow. I would put that in the... spit on their grave. But all right.
Well, when extensions were added to macOS, it brought all kinds of trouble and problems, but it also brought a whole lot of increased functionality. And it sort of unleashed the power, some of the power of the developer community at the OS level. And, you know, again, it was implemented in a way that brought some problems with it, too. And, yes, some of us were psycho and were, like, proud of the number of extensions that we had running without our Mac crashing.
Yeah.
But there were all kinds of things that could be added through extensions that made macOS
fun,
better, sometimes more powerful, sometimes more useful.
Well, it was one of the easiest ways to get some genuine multitasking on the system. Because if it was running in that space, it could keep running concurrently.
Until it crashed.
Well, yeah, until the
entire system. Yeah, there was that.
But it was one of the cool ways to have some pretty cool multitasking things going on. I remember there was it's one of the coolest defraggers back in the day when you used to have to defragment your hard drive. And I forget the name of the company, but... it ran as an extension. I think it was like an extension and an init and a menu item, right? Like it was like every hack possible. But what was cool is that one ran in the background because you want your system constantly defragging, right? Because that's good for the hard drive. That's good for performance. That's good
was
for
that
everything.
Was that Disk Doubler?
I don't remember. But it gave you this cool graphical view where you literally see the little square blocks being fixed as it goes along.
I spent a lot of time watching that.
In a system where there's no protected memory, that's what you want going on in the background, reading, writing blocks out constantly. Only good things can happen from that. So that was awesome.
Yeah, that's why we had good font management, like proper professional font management. It's because we could have extensions.
It's true. That's true.
And of course, then there are companies that instead of writing their tools for using their, you know, like high-end printing equipment, writing it properly, they would just be like, oh, let's make an extension, we'll throw it in at the system level, and that'll be a lot easier. And then, of course, you'd have this really unstable, very customized extension loading for some esoteric offset print plate printer that would just crash your system all the time. Oh, good times.
Good times, yeah. I was just thinking about good times. Good times.
Yeah. You know, why didn't they just make a printer description file like proper people and let us manually throw that into a folder and do you remember doing that? Just like getting people to, hey, do you have this this printer description file? Can you throw it on a floppy and bring it over to me?
Because I can't find it anywhere. I do remember that. I would love to ask Dave this, but back when in his computer repair days, I'm thinking that he actually carried around a bunch of those.
Oh, I did back in when I had my consulting company. Yeah, I had a floppy disk loaded with a lot of printer description files because I would have clients that would lose them, or they'd get a new device and they couldn't figure out how to get the right printer description file. Yeah,
you couldn't download them.
Right.
There was no downloading. What does that mean?
Right. So I'd show up, I'd pop a disk in there, in their computer, copy the file off and throw it where it needed to go. Good times.
That's funny. That is super funny. Kind of emphasize this point. Did anyone besides me spend time watching their disk defragger working?
Yeah, it was hypnotizing.
It was hypnotizing. It was absolutely mesmerizing. Okay, all right. Just want to make sure that I mean, I am a weirdo. I just wanted to make sure that I wasn't a lone weirdo, at least in this particular regard.
No, you're not.
Okay, excellent. Yay, me. What do you got, John?
So I'm gonna dump three in one, even though they're not terribly related, but they kind of are. Spotlight, File Vault, and Time Machine, and the Spotlight I think is life changing. We don't even pay attention to I use it dozens of times a day, every day on both Mac OS and iOS, and everything in between. The concept of instantly findable stuff on your system is pretty, we take it completely for granted,
but not only instantly findable, but actually findable.
Right. And then, you can do the preview with the space bar. I forget what we call that. The quick preview, quick look that came along with it. That didn't come along till, Tiger. So it took a while to get that, even though that technology also came out of Next, the digital librarian app had that, although the throughput wasn't quite high enough back then to do what Spotlight does kind of on the fly now. But File Vault also, it kind of carries that concept of security of the system forward, really took it to a next level with encryption being kind of a standard option, and Time Machine. It made backup for a lot of mere mortals possible. Some people decry it now, but I think it's one of the greatest things Apple's ever done, because there are, like, my aunts, and kind of grandmas, you can set it up for them and it's just done, and it's something that they can deal with. Whereas before that, it just wasn't happening. So just that kind of level of backup security and ability to find stuff was a pretty busy time at Apple. That was all between 10.3 and 10.5 that all that stuff came out.
Yeah, you know, I'm with you. Time Machine is actually a really great addition to macOS. And for some people, it's their only backup. For other people like me, it's part of a bigger process. And so Time Machine is doing its thing throughout the day. And if I realize, oh, crap, this file, I just changed it in a way that I really didn't intend to, I can use Time Machine and grab the version from an hour ago and just keep going. And then my more robust, longer term backup systems, that's happening independently at Time Machine. But man, what a great tool that has been over the years. Just if nothing else, to be able to hop in and grab a file from yesterday or last yep. week or an hour ago in seconds and have it and use it.
Yeah, and now the system's doing snapshots even if you don't have an external drive, which I think is kind of cool. It's not clear what the algorithm is, you know, for when it's doing it. I know it's using your free space to basically do that, but anyway, it's just cool that it's everything's getting more fault tolerant, more more secure, and it's just good progression. Those were really solid ads from Apple, and I think. Some of them are just, I couldn't live without them. I can't imagine, coming to the machine and not being able to do a spotlight search. It's just.
No, I completely agree with that. But there is a part of me that feels like Time Machine is going to be axed at any time.
It would not surprise me, sadly. Yeah.
That would suck, but.
But I don't think Spotlight's going anywhere. I don't think File Vault's going anywhere, but. Time Machine doesn't get mentioned enough for me to be confident of its future.
Although, to be fair, they just upgraded it, I think with Big Sur, or maybe it was to the end of Catalina. Somewhere there, they finally made external hard drives that are spinners. Time Machine was only working on HFS formatted drives up until very recently, and they upgraded it to work with APFS. And the mechanism for it working there is very significantly different. The backup is very, so it was a serious amount of work for whoever had to overhaul that. So they did, recently do something with it. But yeah, it doesn't seem to get love in the sense of modernizing the kind of the more forward facing features for the user. But maybe that's also not a bad thing in the sense that they want to keep it super simple and figure people that are fancier can figure out stuff on their own.
Yeah, fair enough. Mm-hmm. All right, so I have one that I want to propose it to you as opposed to necessarily, listing it. But in part because I think it's significant, but I don't think we've seen much fruit from that significance, and that is Catalyst and the ability to run iPad OS and an iOS apps on Mac OS.
I think the significance of that will come, but it's not here yet. And we just need to have more people aware of the feature and more developers creating their apps so that they're Catalyst friendly. It'll come.
Are either of you running iOS apps through Catalyst on your Mac?
But I'm not running an M1 Mac either.
Oh, that's a fair point. And you don't have an M1 Mac yet either, do you, John?
No, I don't. But the Catalyst stuff will work on Intel, too. You're thinking of just running the outright iOS apps, which you need the M1
for. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Catalyst or libraries there. So, I mean, I think it's important, but it's one of those, under the grill things that aren't meaningful to most users, because really what that is, it's just an evolving set of libraries, right? We started with AppKit, then we went to the iOS kit part, and this is a further evolution that makes use of, what's their new programming language?
Swift.
Swift, yeah. It's more Swift-friendly set of libraries. So it's evolving, and they're modernizing it, but it's like new libraries. It'll be helpful for making all kinds of transitions. It'll be helpful for making, I think, apps move to, you know, that old Pop.0 show we did where, you know, the One OS to rule them all, and you have that, I forget that writer's version of it, which is basically the OS will morph to the device you're in front of.
Yeah.
the UI will present you a UI that's appropriate for the device you're in front of, and it will help in that regard. It's kind of, I forget what OS, it might have been 10.5, where they, or maybe it was a little later, where they first started doing the multiple higher resolution stuff where the OS could scale, and it was garbage, like, you know, the first versions of it. But it took them probably like 6 years or so to hone that, and now you don't even notice it. Like the widgets in the OS scale gracefully all the time. Doesn't matter what the resolution of your monitor is, it just works really nicely. And it's a technology like that. Like, I think Catalyst is, you know, a very early version days of kind of that, you know, resolution independence, kind of device independence GUI, and that over time it hopefully will evolve to that. And then it could be very profound, because it gets us to that magical One OS to rule them all, you know, the kind of thing. So I think I'm with you there, that in that regard, it could be very useful, very, very earth-shaking. But we don't know if they're actually going to go in that direction or not, or maybe you have a better sense of it, Bri. But I don't have a sense of it.
Catalyst could be something. Catalyst could be like a widget. Yeah. You know, and I was super excited about widgets on OS X. I thought widgets were great. And I had some widgets, you know, I installed some widgets and had widgets running. And then I just sort of didn't use them. And I think that a lot of people just sort of didn't use them. And they eventually went away. And Catalyst could well follow the same path, but I think that it has a lot of potential.
I had forgotten about the old Mac widgets. Those were great all the way up until we just forgot that we weren't using them anymore. And then one day they were gone, and gone from our memories too.
Yeah. Yeah. They were, there was no big hue and outcry when widgets were deprecated.
I wish Apple would kill things more like that. Like that's one thing they killed where I actually kept using them, because I had a, you know, you could remember, you could just like take a snippet of any web page and it encapsulates the JavaScript.
Yeah.
And you have that widget. It was really cool. I had a few that I still use, but it's, you know, even there I have to admit, like, I'm using this very little. It's not a huge impact. I get why they would you know, retire that. And and, you know, Catalyst, it's true, Jeff, I don't know if you were making the illusion on purpose, or but it's a great illusion if you were, which was, hey, we're getting all these widgets on iOS and iPadOS, right? And you get something, what was the technology we were just talking about? Gosh, I'm blanking like crazy. That could make those widgets cross-available for the Mac, if they use Catalyst for those widgets too, right? You could just start having them as like mini apps that show up on the Mac as well. So they could come back in a different form, I guess.
They could. Jeff, I think we need to transition to the lightning round.
All right, then I'm going to start the lightning round off with QuickTime.
Oh gosh, of course. QuickTime was huge. That's a great one. That's a great one. All right, John, lightning round.
Preview app.
Huh? Oh.
I use preview app thousands of times a day. I don't know. It's endless.
Preview app made it a lot easier for regular people to view more images and PDFs. And then sometimes edit some stuff too.
Yep.
Yes, that's an app that does so much more than what its name implies.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's a crazy powerful little app.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that. The iWork Suite, Lightning Realm.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. I'm surprised we haven't done AppleScript yet.
AppleScript and Shortcuts. Although Shortcuts was on iOS first.
Mm-hmm.
John?
Let's see. The kind of the Blue Box and Rosetta Technologies. They made the transitions really kind of crazy smooth. It's a technology that hopefully nobody ever notices, but it was pretty important.
Super, super important. I feel like that I need to pick a fight with John with this one.
Let me get my popcorn.
Okay.
And I had that fight. Differential learning. I retained the fact that it would pick a fight, and then forgot the thing that it would actually cause the fight. There's something about iOS. All right, you guys keep going. I'll see if I can remember what I was going to say. How embarrassing.
No worries. I have brain farts all the time. How about iChat?
That's on my list.
And eventually iChat AV and messages, but it's all the same thing.
You know, okay, awesome thing about iChat that a lot of people have forgotten or just didn't know about because they came to the Mac much later. It was so cool because it gave us a unified chat tool. I had all the different platforms that I was using in one interface. And to find something today that works as well as iChat did for all the unified chat thing, you just can't find it.
Yeah, it was cool. I remember. I think I still have my Yahoo account in the preferences. I think it's dead.
Oh my God! Yeah. I think I still do too.
Yeah,
I forgot about that. Yeah. Yep. Have we said boot camp yet?
Nope.
It's a good one. Boot camp was huge.
You're going to pick a fight over Blue Box and Rosetta and give a pass to boot camp?
Oh, no. I was going to pick a fight on something completely different.
Oh, I see.
It was something involving iOS, and it's a technology that I think is very cool, and I happen to know that you hate it.
Oh, well, that's a long list. So I see the difficulty in recalling.
Just throw a feature out, and John will fight you over it. It's okay.
So I got it while you're still.
Yeah, you guys keep going with the lightning round.
I think these two are kind of intertwined. Expose and multi-touch gestures.
I
use them all the time, every day. But yeah, your mileage may vary, but I use it all the time.
I've got a quick one. Inkwell that should have been
amazing. Yes.
And Apple never did anything with it besides announce it.
You're on the wrong show, Brian. You're on the wrong show.
you mean that's the episode that?
Yeah, where they kill it.
Yeah. But this is the first side of that coin where it was this amazing technology, It literally was not consequential because nothing was ever done with it.
It kind of came back in iPadOS, so
kind of.
I guess a form of it lives on.
Part of the problem with Inkwell was that if you didn't have a graphic tablet connected to your Mac, you never saw Inkwell.
Yeah. Mm, right. And Inkwell, by the way, was the thing that would take your scribbles with a stylus onto a graphics tablet and convert it into letters.
And I think if I'm remembering correctly, they basically just took the MessagePad handwriting engine and dumped it into Mac OS.
Yeah. OS 10.
OS 10, yeah.
Keep going.
Handoff.
Yeah, all the kind of casting technologies, although I think we kind of mentioned those on iOS, but I think they apply equally, right? Continuity, handoff, AirDrop, all those kind of device casting things are huge. They make life so much more pleasant.
They get us a little bit closer to that dream of Steve Jobs' dream of each device just being essentially a window into all of our stuff.
Yeah.
It's still not the same, but it gets us closer. And I love the whole notion of being able to just fluidly move from device to device, depending on what my task is, and use each thing for what it excels at.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. I agree with that. All right, gentlemen, we're out of time. I hate to say it.
All right.
I hate to say it. We are out of time. I want to thank you both for being here. This was a fun discussion. It's a fun look back in time.
Yeah, I think we saved a few brain cells, at least for me. So that was fun.
And I also want to thank Molecule for being my sponsor this week. And as a reminder, for a limited time, you can save up to $120 on Molecule air purifiers by visiting molecule.com. That's MOLEKULE.com. And using promo code ACM, that stands for Apple Context Machine. You can enjoy free shipping and a 30-day at-home trial on your order, too. That's code ACM at molecule.com. And on that happy note, we're going to do this. And that's this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add a question, you can write me at ACM at MacObserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by CashFly, the basis by Boom Recorded just for TMO. I want to thank Jeff. I want to thank John for joining me. Let me stick something else in here. Jeff, where can we find more of you?
Oh, you can find more of me aimlessly roaming the streets of Boulder, Colorado. Yes. No, wait.
I call that Instagram. Yes.
And Twitter, JGamut on both. And my YouTube channel, youtube.com/JGamut.
That's fantastic. John, do you want to tell us where we can find you?
No, nowhere. You've got better things to do than look for me.
Well, he's not wrong.
Quintessential.